This is the Popmatic Podcast for April 27th, 2016.
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means?
Carpe diem. That's seize the day.
Seize the day.
This is the Popmatic Podcast coming to you from Studio NPL in the heart of downtown Nashville.
Ooh. Ooh.
Because we're cool.
Yeah.
That's the piece of my soul I had to give away.
Thank you, Brian.
This is where you can rock out with your library card out. I am Brian, and joining me today are...
Jeremy.
Bill.
Amanda.
Meg.
Because we are a pop culture podcast, this is part two of our Death and Taxes special.
Welcome back, listeners.
You may have recalled that Bill had picked up a bucket. Now we'll see what he'll do with it.
And because library science is an oxymoron, we did taxes first. So on this week, death!
Woo!
But oh man, that is morbid. So how about things we want to get done before we die? Our bucket lists!
Yeah.
Would you like to start us off today?
Sure. Last week, I talked about Stephen King's It, which was a book that scared me so much I had to hide it away for years before I was finally able to read it. But I'm knocking that one off of my list. But this week, I'd like to talk about another book that scares me, but for completely different reasons. I'm sort of fascinated by shadowy figures who operate on the margins of their fields, folks like Spider-Man co-creator Steve Ditko or crazy geniuses like Brian Wilson. They're not like us. And there are plenty of writers that are like this. J.D. Salinger is so reclusive that he died just to get some privacy. But none of them fascinate me more than Thomas Pynchon. He's an odd pick for me because my tastes tend more toward genre books and books with lots of pictures rather than National Book Award winners and master stylists. But consider this. There are four known pictures of this guy, all of them in black and white, and this doesn't include his cameo from The Simpsons, in which he appeared with a paper bag over his head. And there was a 17-year gap between his 1990 book Vineland and his previous book and the subject of today's talk, the National Book Award-winning Gravity's Rainbow. This book even has a scatological scene in it, which so offended the Pulitzer Prize jury that they withdrew it from contention. So all of that is a recipe for fascination for me. I've read the first page of Gravity's Rainbow several times, and I even own a copy of it. But I've never
made... The first page?
Just the first page?
I think just the first page. I may have turned the page.
I took that book out, first page missing. I was like, is this some prank or something?
Hiding in your neighbor's drawer.
That's like that's part of the plot of the novel. I may have turned the page, but then I just went and listened to Bob Seger. I've never made it through.
Chalka version's better.
Yeah. Wow.
Hot take.
Wow. Shots fired. This book is a long haul, not as long as it, but it's 760 pages of weirdness about the creation of the German V-2 rocket whose arc across the sky gives the book its title, and then a man's sexual activities coinciding with bombs falling on London. So, yeah, there's math and metaphysics and people with names like Pirate Prentice and Tyrone Slothrop. But a friend told me, he read the book and he said, you just have to experience it, man. But that's not exactly what I'm looking for in a book. I want someone to tell me a story, and I don't think writers like Thomas Pynchon have that in mind, really, when they sit down to write. And on that tip, I came across a quote from writer Victor Laval from an interview from March of this year. He said, I'm convinced the main reason literary writers are somewhat averse to plot is because most don't know how to write one. Burn.
Whoa, it's true.
Maybe a more generous way to put it is that they have less interest in such things. Instead, their focus is on the sentence level. A beautiful sentence may matter more than a memorable plot. So I can get behind that. But instead of going for the beautiful experience of beautiful sentences, I keep approaching Gravity's Rainbow like there's some sort of hidden message in it, because that's also something that probably would have in one of his books. Like it's going to reveal something to me that's been hidden for me all my life. But instead, when I read it, I feel like a dullard and I waddle back to my Ninja Turtles and spaceships. There's even a book, which you'll have to get from ILL, by artist Zach Smith, called Pictures Showing What Happens on Each Page of Thomas Pynchon's Novel Gravity's Rainbow. But it's about as impenetrable as the text. It's not as exactly representational in its art style. Another of my tilts at this particular windmill involved consulting the book Understanding Thomas Pynchon, but again, no dice. This book is kind of like my white whale, but I've read more of Moby Dick than I have of Gravity's Rainbow. So maybe I should give up. After all, Thomas Pynchon was supposedly higher than an actual rainbow while writing most of this book. So maybe all the awards and mystery around the book are just literary bong hits from the critical establishment. And I'll give a try to the 30 CD audio version read by the excellent narrator, George Guidel. But probably not. This book is at the top of my bucket list, but it's quickly rising to the top of another list, which has a rhyming name.
Question.
Yes.
So you've only read the first page?
I think I read a little bit past that, but like really not.
Okay.
Like
one toilet trip.
yeah. And it was like a quick one. Like I'd had a lot of fiber.
I'm sorry. Too real. Okay.
Hey, we got the potty joke in, though.
And I need to recommend something that I haven't finished but looks cool one of these days.
Welcome to our world.
Yeah.
Save
us from the realness.
Bill, what's on your bucket list?
Well, Jeremy, on my bucket list is a book, and I know a lot of you will be quite surprised that I would even consider reading it. It's Dr. Zhivago by Boris Pasternak. Dr. Zhivago was the basis, of course, for David Lean's classic film, which was released in 1965. In brief, the novel, like the movie, is named after its protagonist, Yuri Zhivago, a physician and poet. And it takes place between the Russian Revolution of 1905 and the Civil War. Now you're probably asking, Bill, why do you want to read this book?
Bill, why do you want to read this book?
Hey, Bill, why do you want to read this book,
Excellent
bro?
Excellent question. First, I needed something to talk about on today's podcast.
Very nice.
Second,
honesty.
Believe it or not, Dr. Zhivago is a badass book.
Uh-oh.
Let me explain. The book was refused publication in Russia. The manuscript was smuggled out of Russia and published. It was awarded the Nobel Prize for Literature, which enraged the Communist Party of Russia.
Yeah.
Also, do you realize that the CIA used Dr. Zhivago as a tool to provoke dissent in Russia? There is even a book about the subject that we have in our collection, The Zhivago Affair. The Kremlin, the CIA, and the Battle Over a Forbidden Book by Peter Finn. Now, how cool is that?
Very cool.
To tell you the truth, I want to read The Zhivago Affair before Dr. Zhivago. Final note, my brother has read Zhivago, and I asked him how he liked it, and all he said was, it takes Pasternak 10 pages to describe someone walking down a hallway.
Nope.
I'll read Dr. Zhivago when I have plenty of time. Amanda?
Sounds like Tolkien.
I haven't read him either, so
that's okay. I like the
movie. Yeah, me too. But make sure you see it on a big screen.
Is it like 16 hours long or something?
14.
The movie?
Yeah.
No, the break. It's a David Lean, probably like close to three.
Yeah, 3 hours with intermission.
So he's not appropriately named?
Okay.
Amanda?
So it has long been a bucket list item of mine to actually ride a motorcycle.
Whoa.
I don't want to drive one.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to own, because it's too much responsibility. But I could ride with someone, you know, someone I trust way out in the middle of nowhere where no one could possibly drive anywhere near us, therefore lowering the chance of my getting run over when I fall off. I.e. not on the interstate. So when I grew up, in my head, people who rode motorcycles were bad guys. They rode around causing damage and mayhem wherever they chose.
Bam.
And they were definitely folks that I didn't want to get mad at me, not that I really had any interactions directly with them when I was little. So then as I grew up, I found that other cool people rode bikes just for fun. And so it looked like the stereotype I had first learned was completely wrong. And most motorcycle people say that 99% of motorcycle owners are simply riding for the love of riding. So maybe the Hell's Angels were just myths to scare obnoxious biker wannabes. But recently, two books came across my desk, both featuring the Hell's Angels, that described a biker gang just as bad, if not worse, than I originally thought. In the first one, called Breaking the Code, retired police officer Chris Amott and former Hell's Angel chapter president Pat Matter go back and forth telling their respective stories, and I really liked this format because it looked like one guy wrote a chapter, then the other guy would read it and respond and write his own chapter, and then it continued throughout the book. And there, because there was a little bit of, now I don't know what he's talking about when he said this, or he might say this, but this is what really happened.
You know, I didn't hit him with a tire iron. I hit him with a bike chain.
It was friendly. It was, you know, yeah. It was a love tap.
It was only a bruise and not gashing his forehead open.
So that kind of, you know, made it really interesting to see both sides of the same story. The other book I read on this topic was called No Angel by Jay Dobbins. Jay was a cop that actually went undercover with the Hell's Angels to try to bring them down. I didn't find this one quite as enjoyable. He kind of got a little bit of a swelled head as the book went on, but he did
from
a better
all the beatings.
Sorry. Well, they are badasses, so. But I think that the Dobbins book did a better job actually explaining the culture and the history of the Hell's Angels. It wasn't quite as just the story. It was actually gave a little background. So it turns out that there really are big bad motorcycle gangs. So some of the stereotypes are true, but that mean doesn't make me want to not ride. I still want to go for a ride, and I hope that I do not get helmet hair.
You read Hell's Angels by Hunter Thompson?
I have not.
Yeah, it's good.
Is that next on my list?
It's pretty scary.
I don't want to read scary.
You know, they show his author photos, what they did to him when he left.
Oh, yeah, don't leave.
Yeah, you know.
If you're in, you're in. It's done like, and done.
Yeah,
I can tell you guys a story.
Ooh. Rival gang.
I'll probably cut that out.
Interesting. Yeah, you.
He might cut something out of you.
My favorite video games of all time is called Full Throttle. There's three things you could do. You can touch something, you could like do something, or you could like put your you could kiss something. So like throughout the game, I'm like trying to like do everything, and it's like you know one line I remember from that game is I'm not gonna put my lips on that. Over and over again.
You just make that.
Well, I'm no way.
You only had to kiss like one thing in the whole game, but you know. And
what,
I put my lips
what
in
the hell kind of game is this? Is this
it's called adventure games.
Is it a motorcycle game?
Yeah,
I just that's played Excite Bike.
That's that where I got the bike chain thing. Like, like sometimes in the games, like you like get behind. Anyway, they're gonna re-release it, gang. I'm very excited.
I'm not gonna put my lips on that.
And then Dad, who's listening to this, was like, "Hey, Mike, Mark Hamill's in this game," and I said, "Goody."
Not so put my lips on him either.
So disgustedly that he still brings it up to this day.
That's not true. That's impossible.
I put my lips on. The best Joker ever. I can picture it like it was yesterday. I was trailing behind my mother in a Kroger in early 1992 when I saw a startlingly awesome book cover. An astronaut floating in space watching a bright orange cloud of gas shooting into the atmosphere near him. This was the new Hugo Winners, Volume 2, presented, because he never actually edited anything, but he took the credit for it, by Isaac Asimov. Not only did the cover blow my mind, but the contest within did as well. It was then that my dream to be a writer began. Eventually that dream would fizzle and die, because I'm both very shy and very lazy. But a new dream arose.
It's probably the latter.
Yeah, I think more the latter than the former. Writers tend to be shy.
Longtime listeners may note how terrible my segments are. Can you imagine that in book form? But then
a lot of puns.
Oh, so many puns. I was thinking of writing an entire book that ended in a pun. But anyway, every time we read a short story where like the writer introduces like this ends in a pun, I warn you now. Disheartens me. Anyway, then a new dream arose to attend WorldCon and vote on the Hugos. The Hugo Awards are a literary award given for achievement in science fiction and fantasy. They've been given out pretty much since the 11th WorldCon in 1953, with one exception, but I couldn't find which one that was.
The Hugo Awards were not given in 1954, but they have been given in every year since 1955.
The cool thing about the Hugos, which, say, the Oscars don't have, is that anyone who attends WorldCon can vote on them. So, you know, keeping up with the Oscars is fun and all, but I don't get a chance to actually vote on them. That is amazing. Plus, you could buy a cheapish membership for WorldCon if you can't make it, which because it's never in a fixed place. You know, like last year was in Spokane, Washington. This year it's in Kansas City, Missouri. I tried to do this cheapish membership last year, but the website was borked the multiple times I did it, and I'm not going to go into the controversy that happened last year, but let's just say I'm glad I didn't vote. Sad puppy.
Sad puppies.
Hugo award-winning stories slash novels tend to be a little avant-garde, a little weird, which adds to the gravitas of the award, at least for me.
Literature.
Since I haven't read a few of the recent ones, and Ancillary Justice and Richards have already been mentioned on the podcast before, I thought I would briefly recommend one of the books that won the best novel in 2010. For you see, there is a tie, and I have yet to read The City and the City by China Mieville, but I have been in the mood to read it since I saw Midnight Special. Spoiler alert! So instead, I'm going to recommend The Wind-Up Girl by Paolo, I can't pronounce that.
Bacigalupi.
Yeah, what he said. The Wind-Up Girl is set in a future Thailand where all oil reserves have been depleted and global warming has increased the coastlines considerably. Money is in the form of calories. Biotech firms essentially rule the world. And the main character of the novel, Anderson Lake, is a spy for a firm trying to find new plants that can be copyrighted. His cover is as the head of a kink spring factory. Most machinery is powered by springs that have to be manually wound by hand. The other major characters of the book are Hawk Singh, an ethnic Chinese man who escaped an ethnic cleansing purge of all Chinese people in Malaysia, and Emiko, a Japanese cyborg sex slave. In this world, to combat their steadily decreasing population, most of Japan is run by synthetic people. The book definitely has a quite American vibe. Lake gets involved with some intrigues in the Thai government, because, you know, for Western reasons and not because of the good of the country, between factions of the trade ministry and the army. Hawk Singh is trying to survive by playing both his employer and the government against each other, and this doesn't turn out so well. And Emiko eventually shows a side to her programming that no one expects. Oh, no. The book is kind of amazing, and it stuck with me since I read it years ago, The Wind-Up Girl.
I want to read that book and have not, like many, many other books, but I listened to the audio version of the Prince Award-winning Shipbreaker.
Also by Paolo Bacigalupi.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, like, hated it.
Really?
And I don't know how... I think a lot of it had to do with the reader, because mm-hmm. I like the story, and, like, I feel like whatever flaws were maybe in the book, like, I would have glossed over those if I read them, because... The guy doing, I guess it takes place sort of, it doesn't really define exactly where it is, but it's maybe like on the Gulf somewhere, like either on the Gulf Coast or something. And then like there's people coming in probably from the Caribbean or whatever. And so some of them have, the guy reads some of them with accents. And I don't think it's written in like that patois or whatever.
Yeah.
But the guy, the main character's name is Naylor. And the main guy's like, Naylor, what you doing on the ship there? You get the boat and you get the copper wire, Naylor. It's horrendous. So maybe don't listen
I listened to The Quiet American as an audiobook, and it was an amazing book and like blew my mind, got me into Graham Greene,
yeah,
you know, and more into like literary stuff than but like his impersonation of a Vietnamese girl was every time she talked, it was just like,
yeah, like I mean,
cringing.
A bad reader can ruin an audiobook.
Oh, yes.
But I still really want to read that book because it sounds great.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I started the really famous trilogy by Cormac McCarthy, the three books.
That would be the Border Trilogy by Cormac McCarthy.
Yeah.
All the Pretty Horses or something?
Yeah. And the first one was read by Will Patton, who's like my favorite audiobook reader. And then the other two the library had by a different reader. And it's like, I don't care who the other reader is. I don't care. It ruined it for me. So on my bucket list would be to find the second two in the Cormac McCarthy trilogy that I will have spliced in by now, read by Will Patton. I want those really, really bad. Now, in regards to my real life bucket list, that's way too personal. I'm not telling any of you guys that. That's horrible.
Wow.
Does it involve Pamela Anderson?
It involves Kerry Washington and Ryan Gosling on a boat.
Okay, you're right. It's too personal. Okay,
I didn't say that I was there.
I was not going to tease you, but I may now.
I didn't say that I was there.
So, but the camera may be there.
So, but this is why it's too personal. There are a lot of things that I'm ashamed to say that I haven't accomplished yet, right? And there are some things that I just don't want to jinx, you know? It's out there on the vision board of the universe. I don't want to jinx them. And then there are other things that I've accomplished. I've achieved them, and I'm very proud and happy that I have, but I'm not going to say where they are. So I'm not going to talk about my bucket list, but I'll talk about someone else's. How about Jamie Stewart of the band Juju? He's the creative force behind the band. And I read an interview once. They're like, hey, man, how's your life going? Whatever. What's going on with your band? He's like, I'm just really happy that my life goals achieved at record labels, like real ones, actually would have put out my records. He's like, really happy and good to go. So the band Juju kind of got a reputation for making like pop music, but with noise mixed in. And of course, I like that. And it's going to be like really sweet, awesome pop songs. But then there's like these crazy experimental passages. And then also Stewart's sort of unhinged vocal approach. He kind of has like stage whisper and then like I am more desperately emotionally wrought than you will ever be kind of screaming. And he goes back and forth between the two. And then also, and this is where maybe where I kind of like them the most, he's like unafraid to not produce his records right, like selectively mix them badly or make them sound bad or be lo-fi, but not all the time. Like sometimes they're really polished. So the same way that he would like scream and not sing, and the same way that he would put in noise and not melodies, he would also like mix the songs so the levels were blasted or things were really lo-fi or recorded outdoors or whatever. And I always liked that experimentalism about Juju. Now, Juju has been around for a while as a band. And side note, digression, tangent, the band is actually named after the Chinese film, Juju the Scent Down Girl, directed by Joan Chen, who played in Twin Peaks. And I thought about talking about that movie or maybe the band Juju in relation on the Chinese episode, but I did not. So Juju's been around for a while, and I kind of lost touch with them because they put out a bunch of records, but like most of us, I'm always looking on Hoopla and Freegal for new music. So I noticed there was a Juju album on Hoopla called Angel Guts Red Classroom, and I was like, okay, you got me. You win. Right. So on this record, like Stewart seems to have eschewed guitars. Am I using that word correctly? Smart yes. Kids. Eschewed the guitars. So, you know, and that's all right, because guitars are for people that need to compensate for something.
Wait a minute.
What the what?
He's not wrong.
That's what my thermos is for.
So it's mostly just like synthesizers and like really like simple beats, but the beats are all like kind of distorted and it really sounds like the band Suicide. And I never thought about this before, but Stewart's approach and Alan Vega's approach in Suicide are very similar in the sense that it's like story, very personal storytelling with like a stage whisper and then screaming. And his lyrics are like hyper personal to the point where they're very subjective. Like, I don't know what any of the songs are about, you know. Here's a sample of what I'm talking about from the song Cynthia's Unisex.
Sounds so gender neutral.
Okay, peer pressure. One thing on my bucket list I would like to do.
Oh, ooh.
Is go to the Twin Peaks Fest with my partner, which happens in Washington once a year. Yeah. The very first time we cosplayed publicly. I did that totally. That was just a setup. That was just a setup. I thought you man. Guys would have so much more. Oh. The very first time.
Wow. You did it privately?
The very
first. Pictures on a boat with Kerry Washington and Ryan Gosling.
That's who I hang with. Who do you hang with?
David Goose!
So the first time we cosplayed, it was as Bob and Laura Palmer from Twin Peaks. Now, it just so happens, why am I talking about this?
Yeah, besides that, the body of Laura Palmer?
Besides that being on my bucket list.
You were Laura Palmer, I'm assuming.
Of course. It just so happens that Juju just released a double LP called Juju Plays Twin Peaks. It's basically their interpretation of the Twin Peaks soundtrack, like music from the TV show and the movie. Now, this only came out for Record Store Day. And of course, it sold out super fast because Record Store Day is a farce.
Yep.
And now, of course, the internet.
We're on the record, we're saying.
The internet pooped their pants because no one could get Juju playing the music of Twin Peaks, but Polyvinyl, their international label, was like, okay, well, this was so popular, we press more. The fact that they did this and everyone wanted it but couldn't get it. And it got such good reviews that the New Yorker actually published a piece about the fact that Juju had re-recorded the Twin Peaks soundtrack.
I really want to hear that. I've never heard this band, I don't think, anyway. I know their name, but that soundtrack was like a big deal for me for a long time, and I'd like to hear it.
I could talk about it for an hour. Maybe I'll save it for later when we get close to the Twin Peaks celebration that will happen when Twin Peaks comes out again later in the year. But It's fantastic. All of Twin Peaks' newer albums are on Hoopla, including...
Wait, isn't Joe correct? All of whose newer albums?
What did I say?
You said all of Twin Peaks' newer albums. So.
There is
that
band.
The TV show or the sexist restaurant?
Are you thinking of the Brestaurant?
Yeah, yes.
No, I'm thinking of...
That was a shock when I found out that's what the restaurant's about.
I'm thinking of the TV show, and there is a band called Twin Peaks. Oh, but anyway, most of Juju's newer records are on Hoopla, including their Record Store Day release that came out last year called Unclouded Sky. So I think hopefully in the future, their version of the Twin Peaks soundtrack will be on Hoopla too, and everything will be right with the world.
Hey, Brian.
What do we do on Tickle My Fancy?
Well, maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy.
Jeremy?
Jeremy.
Jeremy.
Jeremy. Tickling My Fancy this week is Give Us a Kiss by Daniel Woodrell. I've been meaning to read some of his work since I read an excerpt from his novel Winter's Bone in the anthology Grit Lit, A Rough Southern Reader, and I'm glad I finally did. Check that one off the bucket list. Give Us a Kiss is about a writer named Doyle Redmond who returns to his Ozark home to fall in love with a smoking hot hillbilly girl and help his brother grow pot so they can become financially secure. Things get rough when a rival clan try to get their hands on the brother's crop, and there's some gunplay. Give Us a Kiss is subtitled a country noir, and that is like, for some reason, that is like a thing that really tickles my fancy all the time. It is violent and funny, and there are beautiful sentences. I downloaded this from Overdrive, but we have it in print as well, so check out Give Us a Kiss, Bill.
Tickling My Fancy is an offbeat movie from 1945 called Murder, He Says. In brief, the movie, this is interesting, I have hillbillies too.
Is it a prequel to Murder, She Wrote?
No. Oh. In brief, the movie is
Jessica Fletcher's cousin.
Okay.
Sorry.
I'll get through this. It's real brief if you just. In brief, the movie is about a pollster played by Fred McMurray who is looking for a missing pollster who stumbles on a family of murderous hillbillies and joins in a search for hidden treasure. Murder, He Says, co-stars Ma Kettle herself, Margie Main as a whip-carrying matriarch.
Whoa!
Oh, no, faster, pussycat, kill, kill.
Uh-huh. The movie is good, silly fun with a macabre streak, which I appreciate. So the movie I'm recommending that we have on DVD in the library, Murder, He Says, Murder, Amanda.
Nice. So a while ago, I think it was on... It was last summer, I think. Someone mentioned the new movie Concussion that was coming out.
Tell the truth.
That dealt with a concussion crisis in the NFL. Well, I finally got a chance to see it. I actually watched it.
No. You sure you didn't see the trailer?
No, I actually watched the whole thing. 5 minutes worth.
You read about it on IMDb.
I did, yes.
She got a concussion. I did. That's what the movie is like.
I get it. Okay.
I saw Will Smith and Albert Brooks.
So I actually watched the whole thing, and I really enjoyed it. And sometimes when you have a big-name actor like Will Smith, all you can think is, why is Will Smith talking with that funny accent? I didn't know the Fresh Prince was a pathologist.
Naylor!
But in this case, I felt like Smith really portrayed Dr. Amalu well. He portrayed him as hardworking, highly intelligent, and completely naive about the world of football, kind of like myself.
Go Steelers!
Whoa.
I thought you were going to say Steeler Nation.
Whose house?
Okay. Steeler's house. So Dr. Rudy's Amalu house. Had no idea who the big-name players were who were committing suicide, and that's okay, Dr. Amalu. I didn't know them either. But I still thought the movie was good. It was well-written and well-acted, and if you like The Blind Side or Friday Night Lights more for the TV show than the movie, you should definitely check this one out, even if you don't like the foosball. It is a good movie.
It's of the devil. My mother doesn't know I have a tattoo of Roy Orbison on my butt.
And why did they release it at Christmas time? That was the story.
Well, they thought
it was cheery.
War contender. Uh-huh. They were wrong.
Yeah, it's a fall movie.
They should have. Yeah, hello, football season.
So do you think it went soft on the NFL? Because I know that Michael was like, I don't want to see it because they're like, they're going to go soft on the NFL.
I don't think so. I think they kind of, like the basic NFL line throughout the movie was just basically they just ignored it. I don't know that they went soft on it, but they didn't really go into a whole lot of the NFL side of the story. Like, all you saw was Dr. Amalo and them ignoring him and pushing him to the side and attacking his job and all that. Like, you didn't get where they were coming
from.
They
didn't stir that pot, kind of.
Yeah.
So they're not, like, you know, acknowledging that they may have covered up that they knew this for, like, decades.
Yeah, like, because, like, you know, I can't remember what they said at the end of the movie. There was some comment, like, the NFL, like, refused to, like, whatever the agreement they made was they... Like, part of the deal was they never had to disclose when they knew and what they knew. Like, that was part of their settlement.
Isn't that, like, basically an admission that we
do? Yeah, we,
like,
totally do.
My bad.
You can't sue us.
Well, even here within the show, I was like, it's going to be football season. Everyone loves football. Let's do a football episode. So this concussion issue, like, spilled out onto our show. Mm-hmm. And, like, half of our jokes were about how the NFL's horrible. Yeah. Right? So I was like, well, that probably wasn't the best episode. It wasn't the tone I was going for, right?
Yeah.
But, like, you know, it's like we couldn't help but to talk about it. I mean, so it's just, it's interesting. And I kind of want to see the movie, too, because it's set in Pittsburgh.
You'd appreciate it for that. But, I mean, I thought it was really well written on top of it, so...
I heard a podcast, which I'll recommend next week. Tune in, gang. That
spoiler alert.
Supposedly, Howard Hughes' mental deterioration was possibly due to his frequent plane crashes.
Oh, yeah.
Which is interesting.
I hate when that happens.
I know he crashed the plane once. I didn't know that. Like, one time he crashed his plane, he was radically different when he'd recovered. So,
interesting. Yeah, like he had superpowers.
Yes, he could fly.
Radioactive
spider. He's called the Spruce Goose. he could produce Ice Station Zebra like no man can. Well, this week... has been kind of phenomenal for me, possible recommendations-wise, why I could recommend a book, a comic book, two movies, and a gastropub, and a bookstore, but instead, I'll recommend something I've already recommended before.
Why do something new? You know?
Who cares?
Help me out here. As someone who doesn't leave his house, what is a gastropub? Is that a pub? Is that
a bar
where you get
food?
That's
like a bar with actual food.
Bar with fancy food.
Why don't they just call it a restaurant?
Because it's a pub. So
I
you
hate
go to
this
hang
town.
Out. But they have, it's not just Nashville.
Yeah,
it's everything.
I've been to Gastropub.
World. do they serve foam
it's
on
not
plate?
It's not like Applebee's or McDonald's. So
every restaurant is Applebee's
or McDonald's.
Chili's. I want my baby back. May 3rd, one of my favorite new bands, Ghost, is performing at the Marathon Music Works. So you may remember me mentioning that they won some sort of award that people have heard of called a Grammy. I guess it's a thing. I don't care. And
it has a little cute statue.
Welcome to Music City. The guy that's like Gastropub. I don't know what the Grammys are.
Yeah, exactly.
I've heard of them. That's what I call my grandmother.
Gastropub?
I love you, Gastropub. I love that wet towel in your bathroom that you just keep pulling on to.
Why do you keep giving me beer, Granny?
Because you need it, Michael.
Caught on to me at work. My Gastropub has died 5 times.
Sorry, I got a little lost there. My bad.
No, but the comedy
is
go.
Fun.
You know, see, earlier this year, I was like, I'm going to try out new bands that are coming up, you know, partially because Lemmy had passed away and KMFDM is in a creative rut, and partially because I don't want to turn in Jeremy and Bill and just listen to the same stuff over and over.
Wow.
Threw Bill under that bus,
you
too?
Know, nobody wants to be Jeremy and Bill. I tease you guys. I thought that today I recommend a song that doesn't involve the devil. It's called Elizabeth, about Elizabeth Bathory. It is great. He pronounced it Elizabeth for some reason, I guess because he's Swedish.
Wasn't it? Is it because she's like, I don't want to say it, like, awesome. Isn't it like Elizabeth? That's her official.
Yeah.
We had a book in a library loan like continuously for like 2 years about her. So I haven't read it because she's creepy, but this is how I know about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's orange.
Future corrections gang. She was a Hungarian countess who decided to extend her youth by bathing in the blood of virgins.
So her name was already Bathory, and then like she like took a bath, right? That's just a coincidence.
That is
it's not just a clever name.
It's pretty cool.
Those Hungarians.
That's pretty
yes, amazing. John Crapper. You know, just coincidentally a bit at the toilet.
Hey Brian.
What do you got?
What's
Brian?
Happening, person off mic across the room?
Jeremy.
What do you have, Brian?
I can speak loudly.
So tickling my fancy this week was this quote by Ta-Nehisi Coates.
When I was a young person, my introduction, frankly, into the world of literature and the beauty of words and the beauty of language occurred through three things. It occurred through the magic of hip-hop, occurred through the magic of Dungeons & Dragons, and it occurred through the magic of Marvel comic books. And so it was just, I feel back at home, man.
Woo!
And two of three.
So that was on Pop Culture Happy Hour. The whole long version. Now, a condensed version of the interview where he said this was on All Things Considered. He's being interviewed because he is writing the new Black Panther comic. It's notable because he's this National Book Award-winning, snooty literary writer guy. So, I'm as country as a corn cob, so for me it was punk rock, not hip-hop. But what really tickles my fancy about that quote was the Dungeons & Dragons reference. Now, right about the time I heard this Coates interview on the radio, The New York Times also did a feature on this video series they have called Retro Report, where they revisit a story from the past. So the Retro Report was about the Dungeons & Dragons moral panic. So on that segment, Huno Diaz says this about D&D.
This was a revolution, being a bunch of kids of color in a society that tells us that we are nothing, being permitted in under our own power to be heroic, to have agency, to do the hero stuff, to take and be on adventures. There was nothing like it for us. It was very, 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 very impactful.
Now, it seems obvious to me what is happening here. A generation of the most successful writers of our time played D&D as children and sold their souls to Satan for fame. No.
That's not new.
Roll a six or above to sell your soul to the devil.
Come on, snake eyes.
Yeah. Roll three sixes.
What do you think Malcolm Gladwell rolled?
That guy didn't have enough friends to play D&D with. So anyway.
That's funny because it's true.
In the blink of an eye.
I jest. But it is vindicating to see a generation of kids who played D&D. Like now we're old enough. Like all these people that played D&D when they're kids are now adults. And like they are becoming the creative class or the intelligentsia. The NYT Retro Report also mentioned Stephen Colbert and then Pembleton Ward, the guy that created Adventure Time. You know, he's talked about how much D&D influenced him. It's really great. Tickled my fancy. Wonderful. And a long time ago, I think I said on this podcast that a white lady in Iowa was the best prose writer alive. But for my money now, it's probably Coates. So, boom, D&D. Corrections! Jeremy said his dad was born in 1990.
Whoa, how young
like
are
he
you,
he is from
Jeremy?
Kentucky, but that's even maybe impossible.
That's some time loop stuff that I don't understand.
He was born in 1959. I also said I was listening to The Power of Myth from audio, but I got it from Overdrive. I don't know if that was clear or not. But.
Okay. The episode posted on 420 and no one made any pot jokes. I don't know if that's good or bad. I just thought it was notable.
Well, it's a chronic theme in this joke.
Would you leave it alone?
You're burning the podcast down.
I know we're buds and everything, but you're putting us in a sticky situation.
I'll just roach this alone. Anyway.
Pineapple.
I have some corrections. After reading Sudden Death, I realized it doesn't have a feather on the cover, but a quill on a field of green, presuming the meaning tennis.
I don't want to read
writing.
That book anymore.
Bah. And in retrospect, expecting a literary novel to have a cool, groovy cover is silly, like expecting a sandwich without wild tomatoes. So, but the book is amazing, and I would have recommended this week if I hadn't had a Goose D recommendation already in the chamber. And clarification. Robert Graves is the Greek myth one. Starts by listing a world myth and then all conceivable variants of that myth. Well, you see, in variant 1C-12, you may notice that two sentences are missing. While I go... This may appeal to Johnny No Plot Brian, but not, but it's not for moi.
you may recall that I recommended Mr. Graves' novels, not his nonfiction catalogs of ancient myths. All right. Though he did do translations of myths, too, like The Golden Ass. That's hilarious, right? Western satire starts there.
Apuleius.
Anything else?
Golden Ass.
So one more small addendum. I just wanted to point out that Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life by William Finnegan won a Pulitzer Prize.
Score.
And Amanda had wrote a review of that on the Off the Shelf blog. And I also just kind of wanted to give a shout out to Amanda. Since we've started going once a week, Amanda still publishes another blog like about something completely different that she usually doesn't talk about on the podcast every week. And that
is every other.
That is hardcore. I was on that schedule too, and I couldn't do it anymore. I had to stop.
It keeps me out of trouble. Sometimes.
For more great book reviews, you can go to
www.library.org.
And our theme music is by
MD.
You can subscribe to the Popmatic podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Next week,
Mother's Day.
Something, something, another.
I almost said,
that's how much
we don't
you
need to do a Mother's Mother. Day episode, do we? Then I guess that's what we're doing.
Surprise!
Listen up, all you mother.
Hey, children.
Nothing, nothing,
nothing.
Mother. Mama. Life had just begun.
Ooh, nice segue.
I was trying to go there. I couldn't get there.
Don't
I don't have a singing voice this
morning. Grow up to be
bringing it back to reality.
Oh.
I'm approaching 40, and themes of death and loneliness are concerning me more than cars and girls.
Well, and not theoretically, vampires are already dead, so isn't that kind of a topic about death, too?
Yes.
So there.
Fair enough. We come back around to that with Kokomo. Right.
Full circle.
I'd read books about vampire girls and cars.
Do vampires pay taxes?
They should.
Well, they're immortal, and they've, like, you know, stashed vampires. All that money.
Imagine how much money you'd pay in taxes over an immortal life.
Yeah, that'd be
That's depressing. And I brought us down.
I heard an amazing time travel story where this guy funds a time machine by going back in time and putting a penny in a bank account in the Renaissance.
Smart.
And then when he cashes it, the bank cries.
Bankers.
They're like, "Well, sir, we were told when this account was founded to give it to you in this distant year of 1997 or whatever it was written." You know, it's one of those old-timey stories. Yeah, the future.
Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. The Latin term for that sentiment is carpe diem. Now, who knows what that means?
Carpe diem. That's seize the day.
Seize the day. Gather ye rosebuds while ye may. Why does the writer use these lines? Because we are food for worms, lads.